This is David Colburn. I'm interviewing Bruce Rogers. It's March 18th, 2010, and I'm interviewing Bruce at his home. Bruce, if you would give me your full name, I would appreciate it, and your date of birth.
This is Bruce Frederick Rogers, and my date of birth was November 24th, 1924.
And you are now retired.
That's correct. I'm retired.
Okay, and what war do you serve in and what branch of service?
Served in World War II in the Air Force.
Okay. And what was your rank at the time? Well, what rank did you achieve?
I was a captain.
And did you enter as a captain?
No, I entered as a private.
Well, we will talk about that.
We entered as a private in the Army because at the time the Air Force was not accepting enlistments. And so in order to get in, I volunteered to go in the Army and found out the politics of getting transferred to the Air Force.
Okay. You served from what period of time to what period of time?
Was the November of 42 until the 14th day of August 1946.
Okay.
And then I spent 15 years in the reserves.
Okay. Why don't we start by talking a little bit about your background, where you grew up, where you went to school. So why don't you start us with where you grew up?
All right, I grew up in Detroit and went to grade school.
Tell us about your family a little bit.
My mother and dad, my dad was a foundryman by profession. I had one brother who was 3 years younger. And we all went in the same school until high school. In high school, I went to a vocational high school in Detroit called Cass Technical High School. And interestingly enough, this is a point of interest, let's put it that way, I had as a chemistry teacher Charles Lindbergh's mother, who was, in addition, a neighbor of mine. Well, a neighbor, she was within walking distance. So I got to meet her son Charles on at least three different occasions, which I thought was exciting. She was an extremely good teacher. She taught chemistry, and she had her doctorate from Heidelberg. You can remember some of those teachers that really got through to you. Chemistry was not my favorite subject, but she was very good.
Did she exhibit any of the opinions that Charles Lindbergh did about, you know, he was opposed to the war, American intervention. He was sympathetic to Germany. For much of that period. Did that come through in any of her teaching?
Well, see, this was preceding the war by a good bit, and we got, mostly the inference was not through his mother so much as news media. We picked up some, and she would accept any kind of questions they had very readily. And matter of fact, she would, by being a neighbor, we also were tipped off when her son was going to come and visit. And of course, he was one of my heroes, Charles Lindbergh, in the aviation field. So it was pretty interesting to me to actually shake his hands and be brought up to date. And he was very personable. Mm-hmm. And of course, at that point, we weren't really concerned too much about his politics.
It was
secondary.
Yeah, what years would those have been, Bruce?
That would have been like in 39, 40,
okay.
41. See, I was a senior and graduated in 42. So it was in that time period.
What was it like growing up in Detroit in the Depression?
Well, my family was fortunate and unfortunate. My dad was running a foundry in Windsor, Canada, across the river. And he foolishly took on a contract because he was geared to be building tank parts for the Canadians and the Allies. We were not yet fully involved in the war.
Yeah, this would have been before.
It was about 39.
The war started September 1, 1939.
Yeah. So it was between 39 and 41. And mm-hmm. Things were tough. I mean, very tough. Depression. Matter of fact, my wife doesn't always believe that. I said, my brother and I shared a pair of shoes to go to school. And we couldn't afford two pairs of shoes or two new ones. He was growing so fast that he could get into my shoes and I couldn't wear his, so I had one pair of shoes. So and they wouldn't let us go barefoot, so we had to alternate. Fortunately, he was 3 years behind me, and he would be missing. His was kindergarten, and of course I was second grade or third grade. But it was that difficult. We were exchanging, what did we used to call it, for haircuts. Haircuts were like a quarter, 25 cents. And we couldn't afford one, about one every 6 months. And, they were giving script to the teachers because the city had no money to pay them. And fortunately, we were having enough funds, adequate funds to feed us all, but we were scratching. It was difficult.
The unemployment rate in Detroit was pretty high.
It was very high.
It was probably close to 25% during that, before the war started and before the United States started to build up its military force.
I can remember not having the money for the rent. We were renting a home on Collingwood Avenue. And right at that time, cash flow-wise, there wasn't enough to pay the rent. The landlady would pound on the door, and my mother would chase me back into the dining room so that she didn't see anybody was home. It seems funny now, but at that time, yeah. It was pretty serious.
Do you remember soup lines?
Indeed. We saw soup lines. At my age at that time, some of those things kind of went by us. Mm-hmm. There's some things we vividly remember, but hopefully we were somewhat shielded. And
were your neighbors in a similar boat?
Our neighbors on either side where we lived at that time, yeah, they were in a similar boat. One was a CPA, and his business was down. They were not quite up against it quite as desperately, but they, on the other side, they were in fact retired, so they were really in worse shape because they were not properly funded for retirement, and they were on welfare, so to speak, best of my recollection.
Now, you went to a vocational school. Why vocational school?
Because they had a program, an aero program, and I was interested in flying to not only in stress science, as well as the pre-courses for university. They had excellent courses in the manual arts, things like welding, woodcraft, cars. We built an airplane and actually flew it when we were in high school. Complete, starting from a crashed airplane that went down at the Wayne County Airport. And we learned all about the intricate parts of welding aluminum, building internal combustion engines and electrical procedures and mechanical drawing, and like I say, chemistry and physics. And we did get advanced math courses there. We went through integral and differential calculus, pre-engineering, which gave us better prep actually for college engineering than the regular schools. It was difficult because they were in central part of Detroit, and most of us came from outlying parts of the city where it involved taking a streetcar and a bus to get to school. And school started at 8 o'clock in the morning, which means we left before 7. And our classes weren't over until 5 in the afternoon, so we didn't get home till 6. So we're looking at today's students that they're in class time. We never saw the light of day in the in the wintertime. We were gone in the dark and we came home in the dark. And
your interest in flying, did that grow out of having Charles Lindbergh's mother as a teacher, or did that come?
Some of that came from stories of reading about Charles Lindbergh and hearing about him. I remember when he flew from St. Louis across to New York with the Spirit of St. Louis. We saw that flight go over. We were in Port Clinton, Ohio, which is right on the edge of Lake Erie, and it was announced that he was going to fly over it. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a day when you could see him actually go over. Now, we're pretty sure that was him. I'm sure that if somebody very knowledgeable, and you couldn't really read the Spirit of St. Louis on the airplane, but at that time there weren't too many single engine planes flying around. There was so we're pretty sure we saw him going from west to east to New York prior to going to Europe. That was in 1927. So I was about a little over 3 years old, I think, three, four. So I can remember that.
Now you finished vocational school when?
1942.
And where were you when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor? And how did you react?
I was sitting at a drawing board making a machine drawing for a class when we heard it on the radio. We were listening to it on the radio. And when that hit, of course, we were flabbergasted. But the comments at the time were, oh, those guys, this war's not going to last very long. That Japanese, goodness gracious, this war's going to be over in a month from now. This is what the thinking was for at least a few days.
What did you know about what was going on in Europe? Were young people your age much aware of what was taking place in Europe?
I think they were virtually ignorant of it. I'm sure they were. We had very little discussion. We did have a young lad who happened to be a swimmer in our group who was from, I'm trying to think the city it was, I think he was from Nuremberg, who had escaped and came over, and he was, we couldn't understand why he was in our class. This was intermediate school now, so it was about 1938, I believe, 39 maybe. He and his mother had escaped from because they saw what was going to
be happening. Were they Jewish?
They were Jewish, yes. And he was a good swimmer. I mean, he's a tall guy, but we couldn't understand why he was back in our grade until sometime later we figured out, well, he didn't he came over speaking only German. He didn't speak English. He had to learn the English. And so he was probably at least 2 years older than we were, maybe three. And yet he rapidly caught up.
I gave Jack the phone, so when the phone rings, he'll answer it. Tell him you're detained and I'm gone. Some more interruption.
Okay.
The you were not yet graduated from vocational school when Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Was there a sense that you were going to be called to active duty by you or your peers?
At that particular time, we figured we would finish high school before we got called up in the draft. But of course, we all had to register and did register. Matter of fact, we were, I guess it was 18 when we had to register. I'm not quite sure of that date, but I think it was.
Yes, 18 would be right.
So I was not quite 18 when this happened. I wasn't 18 until actually we graduated. I was on the month of November.
Now, were you... were you drafted into the military, or did you volunteer?
I volunteered. I volunteered, knowing that we would be drafted pretty soon, and we were in a state of limbo. We are graduating from high school. The universities are saying you can't get in because we're not sure how many new people we're going to be able to take. And there were no jobs, and so the draft, I said, I'm not going to sit around in limbo and be a drag on my parents. I'm going down and enlist. So,
how many of your classmates did roughly the same?
Ooh, my close associates, all of them did, in different directions. Some went in the Marines, some went in the Navy. Three of them went in the Air Force. My boyhood chums all went in the Air Force.
And what about, was there a sense that women were going to be a part of this process, that women were going to have to work in the factories while the men went off to war, or was this just a little bit too early yet?
I think it's at that point, I think it was a little too early. At least we weren't cognizant that the labor force was being taxed to that extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that this happened until actually we were in the military.
Now, where were you once you volunteered? You were sent where?
We went from Detroit to Kalamazoo, Michigan, to a REPL depot camp there where they put us into military, got all our military gear, whatever the entering group, the basic training garb that you needed was put together, and then we were sent off by train to, actually to El Paso, Texas. At this point, I was still in the Army. And we were sent to an anti-aircraft group in Fort Bliss, Texas, right across the street from Biggs Field, which was very fortunate because I had passed the written exam for the Air Force, but I had to take a physical and get permission to transfer. I couldn't do that until I think I had to stay on base there for 15 days before I could go across the road to Biggs Field, take a physical, and went over there and passed, and the paperwork started to affect the transfer. That transfer didn't take place until my anti-aircraft battery actually departed for overseas, which was probably 3 months. If I remember.
And where did the aircraft battery go?
They went to the African invasion.
Artillery battery.
They went to...
so they went to North Africa.
They went to North Africa. Yep. Uh-huh. You know, I corresponded with a lot of my associates there. They all came from Hamtramck in Detroit, and they were all of Polish extraction and nice bunch of guys. Like, I really was kind of sorry to leave them when the transfer came through. And we corresponded for quite a long time to APO addresses.
Mm-hmm. How did your parents and your brother respond as you went off to fight the war?
Well, my mother was quite concerned. My brother thought I was a hero by getting involved, and he said, "I can't wait to do the same thing." He was 3 years younger. But my mother, she married my dad in the First World War. At the time, he was departing for overseas to go to Europe in 1917. So she was pretty concerned.
And did you write home frequently, or how did that work?
At that time, we had developed V-mail. I wrote probably, initially maybe once a week, and then it became once a month, and then once a quarter. It stretched out. But seldom a telephone call. We didn't talk. It was strictly by mail.
And when you were accepted into the Air Force, what sort of training and where did you go through that training?
Well, let's see. First, we went into the Air Force Training Command, and where did we start out? I have to think about. We were sent to, surprisingly enough, Miami Beach, Florida, where the training command was putting us through what the military had as far as basic training. And we had already had some of that in Fort Bliss in Texas. So it was old hat to some of us, except the new marching regimen and some of the very basics. Then they took and sent us to ground school college in Cove College, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which was at that time a Presbyterian girls' school, actually, where they began training us in things like physics, weather, navigation, and we started primary flight school.
Tell me if I could back you up for just a second. How long were you in Miami?
Oh, golly.
3 months?
Probably 3 months. Mm-hmm. That sounds about right.
And where did you stay?
Oh, my goodness. We stayed in the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach, of all places. And we marched to the polo grounds there for our drill work, right up Collins Avenue. Went swimming in the ocean. It wasn't bad duty. The weather was hard to get adjusted to, but
were you there during the summer or?
Let's see. This time period was yes, yeah. It was hot.
And two things. Was your first trip outside of Michigan when you went to El Paso? Was that the first time you've been out of? Well, I guess you may have crossed the Canadian border.
But, oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
the first real opportunity to travel significantly was when you went to El Paso.
That
I get
was about
it.
Right. Yeah. There was no. We would travel to relatives in Cleveland. My family was original home. My parents were from Cleveland, and we would travel to Cleveland in Ohio. But that was about the extent of it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we went to the World's Fair in New York. That was a big trip. That was exciting. But
did you know anything about Miami before you went there? Or?
No, absolutely not. And once we got down there, we couldn't understand why Miami. There's no airports there. At that time, we weren't involved with flying except on textbooks. And we couldn't understand except the military didn't know what else to do with us. And this is true. We found out later, but one of the problems we had, we needed air crews. We needed trained flying personnel, but we didn't have any instructors to train, or they didn't have training planes. And so they were really killing time, so to speak.
Did you have a sense that Miami or Florida was a place you wouldn't mind going back to after the war was over?
At that particular time, I don't think we gave too much thought to that. Mm-hmm. It was, we were at a position right then as when are we going to really get into what we're supposed to be doing, mm-hmm. speed it up. And so,
how about the guys with you? Were they from all over the country?
Pretty much, yeah. Come from all different walks of life, so to speak. And all, fortunately, all had about the same interest. They wanted to get our training going as fast as possible.
And
they were not, as none of us really were military people. We weren't in there to climb the military ladder, so to speak. So what we were interested in was becoming pilots, navigators, bombardiers, whatever, in the Air Force.
And did you all have a sense you were sort of in this together? This was to protect the very nature and well-being of the country.
You know, I think that was pretty much foremost in our mind, yeah. We thought that, right to a T, that the way to win this war was to increase and improve our Air Force, because that's the way we're going to beat the Germans and the Japanese, although most of us were thinking Germany more than Japan at mm-hmm. that time.
Mm-hmm. And so from Miami, remind me again, you went to Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Cedar Rapids to Coe College in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
And did they have the folks to train you in the machine, the aircraft to fly?
We had light civilian single engine planes. Most of them were old, had been around for a while, flyable, and we had civilian flight instructors who were given the equivalent rank of second lieutenants, but were literally civilian flight instructors. And we learned the fundamentals of that level aircraft, which most of them were 100 horsepower or less, some side by side, some tandem. We had Aroncas, we had J-3 Cubs, we had, we had no biplanes, they were all single engine. And we had the usual run of, I think Jack's going to grab the phone out there.
It's just, okay, good. Did you get, once you had the training, did you fly daily on these machines?
We would fly, probably weather permitting, about every other day. That's because of space limitations. There didn't seem to be a fuel problem, but there was an instructor problem.
Mm-hmm.
Could only take one student in each airplane, and to go through the whole class, we couldn't get up more than 1 hour per day every other day.
Mm-hmm. How many were in your group that was being trained? Is it roughly how many?
20?
20, okay. I believe,
maybe there was 20 or 25.
And was your class there to be trained for a fixed period of time and then a new class would come in? Is that how it worked?
Yes. We were in there for the time period. They had a schedule of what we were to accomplish, and the time period in which this was done was either adjusted by when that class could move to the next stage. And that was dependent, again, on instructors and airplanes.
Well, do you recall the stages you went through before you were certified to fly and ready to be assigned?
Do you mean as far as primary flight instruction, basic and advanced? Yes.
Okay.
And these time periods would, they were actually established by the number of flight hours you could get in and class, certain amount of class time. So between primary and basic, we finished primary, and then because of the basic school and the BT-13s were in short supply, I went to a navigation school in San Marcos, Texas for some navigation training, and then into basic, and then between basic and advanced, I went to a bombardier school out in Ontario, California for what were short courses, but what they were doing is keeping us occupied until the next level became available in the training schedule.
And how long did this last for? How long were you between the various places like Cedar Rapids and Ontario and so forth before you were ready to be sent overseas?
About 18 months.
About 18 months.
I'm guessing now, but I think it was about right.
And that would be from approximately when to when?
Well, let's see. We went overseas the end of May in 1944.
Okay.
And
so sometime around, say, December of 42 to May of 44, would that be about right?
That's about
being
right.
Trained?
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As you went through to the time period when we were going to be assigned an aircraft and decide what type of equipment we were going to fly, the training became more oriented to where your final assignment was going to be. That was determined somewhere up here.
Mm-hmm.
By your, so we knew when we got done with multi-engine training, which was in Lockburn, Columbus, Ohio, and sent to phase training for B-17s, we were pretty sure that we were going to go to the Eastern Theater, not to the Far East. We were going to the UK because we could see our training being slanted that way.
Mm-hmm. The assignment for you to be a navigator, how was that determined? Why were you not selected to be a pilot, for example?
Well, I was.
Oh, you were. Okay.
I was.
And you ranked during this period?
Well, we were in the cadet program. We had the same rank as the guys in West Point have today. And we weren't commissioned until we were finished with our advanced training. Advanced flight training, you were commissioned.
And what were they paying you at this point?
Ooh, that's right. We were getting paid. We were getting paid the equivalent of a private in the Army plus our flight pay, which I think was like $100 a month bonus. That's to the best of my recollection. Mm-hmm. I remember when I took my $6.50 out for my insurance and my laundry, I didn't have much money left. It was very little.
Did you send money home, or did you just put it in a savings account, or what did you do with it?
Until I was commissioned, until we got to officer status, there was no money to send home. At that point, I did send. Mm-hmm. And of course, overseas, I sent it all home. So.
Can you tell me a little bit about the group of men that you were associated with and who became friends and so forth, who were going to serve with you as on bombardiers? What were they like? What was their background?
All right. I think you're talking about when we got our crew together to... We had my co-pilot, George Morgan, was from Illinois. He had a year of college at Ripon College, was a tennis player. My bombardier, whose name was Homer Beaver, was from Quitman, Texas. I remember we were taking our phase training in Ardmore, Oklahoma, which is just north of the Texas border, and we would have to fly down. He kept saying, "Well, we want to go a little bit more eastbound here," and I kept saying, "Why?" And he said, "I'm from Quitman, and I want to fly over my house, and it's right down here." I had two guys on my crew named Smith, A.O. Smith and a D.O. Smith. A.O. was my engineer and D.O. was the radio operator. My ball turret gunner was from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. My tail gunner, he was from New Jersey. Then we had, in addition to a bombardier, we had a toggler. A lot of people don't know this, that all the airplanes that were flying over there didn't carry a Norden bombsight. They didn't have enough Norden bombsights. So that you would drop your bombs on a signal of lights from the forward aircraft that did have a Norden bomb sight. Okay. So those of us who didn't have a bomb sight had a toggler, and all he did was toggle the bombs out when the red light went on. Two waist gunners, one was from Kansas, and the other guy was, I think, from Mississippi. All of them seemed to have had some mechanical training. Seriously. We had no one with a college education in there. No one had completed college. My radio operator had a year of college. So...
There were, what, roughly 10 of you?
There were 10 of us, exactly. And our age ranges were from about 18 or 19 to probably 30, in that age range.
Now, who was 30?
The engineer was 30.
Okay.
Yeah. He had some previous experience in And he was the engineer. So he was my expert on keeping things flying.
You really had an interesting mix of people, didn't you? You were from all over the country.
Yep. A pretty sociable group. And they were all pretty good at what they did. I will say that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were fairly compatible. We didn't basically have too many. The last disagreement I had was with my ball turret guy. When we went from Lincoln, Nebraska, we were supposed to leave Lincoln to go to Westover Field to get our airplane. And he was supposed to come back from leave, and he never showed up.
Mm.
And no phone calls, no, at that time they were using Western Union wires. And I thought, we're going to have to leave without him, and he's going to be court-martialed, and he's in serious. And finally he showed up, and he had a real legitimate excuse. He was not AWOL, but we are great concern. I had chewed him out. I said, you know, there's telephones and there's Western Union offices. You could have let us know. We could have helped you. But we basically got, as a group, we got along very well. Which hopefully you do.
You guys were together for how long?
Oh.
From 44 till, you must have come together even before 44?
No, 44. We didn't come together until we were right before we went overseas.
Okay.
And I put the crew together.
And so you were together?
We stayed together from then until about. It was June or July of 1945.
Yeah, okay.
And then what they did, they took our non-flying, when I say non-flying, active crew members who weren't involved with flying airplane or navigating, they were sent home. And we were reassigned my radio operator, pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, got assigned to an OSS mission after the end of the war in Europe. Between there and when we thought we were going to be sent back here to get trained on B-29s to go to Japan, they put us in this OSS Casey Jones project. And so that many guys stayed with me until we came home
okay.
in 1946 in August.
Well, let's go back to when you get assigned, you get your orders to go to Britain.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been in 44, you mentioned.
That was in May of 1944.
And where did you leave from, and where in the UK did you go?
We got an airplane in Westover, Massachusetts. We flew to Miami, and we flew to Natal, Brazil, and then we crossed to Ascension, Marrakesh in Africa, and then up to the UK.
Why that route?
The southern route.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Its weather was involved.
Okay.
The fact that in those days, the navigation aids, of course, were almost non-existent. So we had to use celestial. Fuel was a problem. Then we went to a spot in the UK called Stone. I don't know whether I could take you back there or not, but in Stone, England was the it was the 8th Air Force REPL depot, where they were then to assign your crews to whatever heavy bomb group you were going to end up flying with. And that was less than a week.
So about a week you're in Stone.
Yeah, but maybe hardly time to to find your way around. Then they sent us to our assigned bomb groups, which was, in my case, 96th Bomb in Snetterton Heath in the UK.
How do you spell that?
Snetterton Heath.
Snetterton.
Right.
Snetterton.
It was about 15 kilometers south of Norwich.
Okay.
South of
right
the Wash.
On the coast.
Well, we were south of the Wash and yeah, about it was less than 100 miles in from the coast. It was just south of Norwich.
Okay, so you're east of Cambridge.
Yep.
And south of Norwich.
Yeah, just yeah, southeast of Norwich.
Yeah.
Right on the rail line. The little town of Attleboro, which Air Force Base today is a racetrack. It was decommissioned.
So take me through your first flight, your first bombing mission, and where...
Well, the first flight we had was an orientation flight, which we kind of looked askance at, but it became apparent was much necessary because of the vast number of airfields in the East Anglia area. When we got up, you couldn't find your airbase. You didn't know which one of them you belonged to. So someone had to be along that would say, here's the landmarks, here's your Bunsher Beacon. These are the salient points which you quickly had to assimilate to find out once you're coming in there where the hell you're going to put your airplane back down on. So you made two of those kinds of flights.
Now, did you do that orientation flight at night as well as day?
No, this was strictly daylight.
Now, is it true that you guys flew during the daytime, the Brits flew at night?
That's right.
And you guys flew at daytime?
We all flew at daytime.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Daytime missions would start at 1 o'clock in the morning for briefing. And in most cases, your mission started at daybreak when you could see based on weather.
Mm-hmm.
And that could vary from, which we were all on Greenwich Mean Time, but it was generally sometime between 8 o'clock and maybe 10 in that time range based on the visibility and weather. Weather was a big factor.
So you guys were up at 8 to 10 hours, or, mm-hmm. 8 to 10 hours before you even took off.
That's right. You were up to pilot's briefing, navigator's briefing, bombardier's briefing, and these varied. Our pilot's briefing was relatively short, but the navigator and the bombardier's briefing were usually involved with the target and where you're going, mission route. Your codes, there was a whole bunch of things that, and it could last an hour sometimes, mm-hmm. sometimes only 30 minutes.
So what were they telling you at these briefings, and particularly in your role, what were they telling you?
Well, first of all, they were telling about formations, who's going to be the leader and what flight you were going to be in, the altitude we were going to be flying at, escape mechanisms in case you were shot down, how you got back, where you went, who you contacted, and these things, the signals and codes involved with this changed by the day. The color code for the day was given. The signal, and it was changed every single day, every single mission. Navigator's briefing, they would go over the route, the initial points, the target we were going to go to, weather, altitude, and they were responsible for keeping the score on And your G-Box coordinates, these are the navigation devices we used over there, which was nothing but Shoran and Waran at that time. Bombardier briefing was about the same. They were given pictures of the target and aerial photographs that were taken that they could see, so that when that time came, they weren't a surprise to them.
And when
most of the time the gunners were busy, the rest of your crew were out there getting their machine guns back on the airplane and making sure they were functional and that they had all the ammunition they needed and that sort of thing.
After you all received your separate briefings, your crew, did you all come together to talk about what each of you had learned? Did you compare notes before you took off, or how did that work?
Generally not. The pilots, we usually went to navigation and bombardier briefing in addition to our own. So we were pretty much fully informed, as you could be, I guess. The brief meeting before taking off and loading is when you got to brief the rest of your crew, tell them what you were doing, and you told them what targets you were going to go to. They generally didn't know.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about a typical mission. Maybe your first one, you want to highlight. We'll talk about some of the others, but let's just talk about a typical mission.
Well, we'll talk about one that went to Frankfurt from takeoff. Well, I guess one that's worthy of discussion would be a 1,000 plane raid, which was an infrequent happenstance, but it did occur when we were really giving the Germans up. This was not initial, this was later in the war. Matter of fact, the Berlin missions were like in February of 45. But those were 1,000 plane raids, and that was a real interesting experience where all of your 8th Air Force groups took off, and you would climb 18,000 feet, break out of the clouds, and there were airplanes going in every direction. You all had a bunch of beacon that you gathered around with your own particular group. It was very well organized. First time that you experienced that, if you were not a lead crew, it could be very confusing, and you had to really look for your flight leader, who is supposed to be firing a designated cord flare that you could see visually to gather up for formation. And it sometimes took as much and as long as 2 hours to actually gather everybody together to start your trek to the over Germany.
So this was as you gathered over the North Sea, I would imagine.
No, actually, you would be gathering over the land. In many cases, right over your own airfield.
Right over East Anglia. Mm-hmm.
I have a picture of this if you might want to see it. It's dug out.
Oh, yeah. And
each one of those spots had a transmitting Butcher beacon, which was good for probably a 25-mile radius distance, which you were orbiting around until the leader would give the signal to put the whole formation together. It was a very complicated sequence of events.
Now, on this one, this must have been related to trying to stop the Germans' offensive at the Bulge, or to turn the tide offensively so the American troops, as winter ended, could begin their offensive into Germany.
That's right. Well, there are two major thousand plane raids, I would say, were actual psychological raids to convince the Germans, because they were to Berlin, and Berlin was not basically an offensive spot. It was population, and they just went in there and just bombed the hell out of Berlin.
Yeah, it wasn't like Berlin had military factories either.
That's right. They were...
So it was psychological. It was to intimidate the Germans.
But the other raids that, of course, we went in to hit their military, Schweinfurt for ball bearing plants, and Frankfurt for the Focke-Wulf airplane plant, and then railroad yards, which are all strategic, and the Pulaski oil fields, of course, early in the game, to damage the war machine, basically.
Now, how far into Europe did you fly from England? Did you go all the way to, say, Poland from East Anglia?
We went, the longest mission, actual active mission, I flew in further, but the active mission was to, Linz, Austria.
Oh, to Linz?
Then we went to Austria. Linz because at that particular time our advisors were saying that Mr. Hitler was bivouacked in his eagle's nest at Berchtesgaden, and that he was being supplied by rail and trucks coming by rail going through Linz marshalling yards. And so we want to go in there and knock out the marshalling yards, which we did. But that was about as far east, weather permitting, that you could actually go.
Yeah, you probably couldn't get back if you went much further.
That's right. So we carried 2,700 gallons of fuel, and we burned, if we weren't leaning things out, we burned about 400 gallons an hour. So we, of course, would lean it out until the cylinder head temperature started going above the gauges to save fuel. So that was about the extent of our range.
Mm-hmm.
But most of those missions lasted between 6 and 8 hours.
So if you didn't take off till 10 in the morning,
mm-hmm.
then you were flying 6 to 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Which would take you to anywhere from 4 to 6 o'clock. You guys didn't get much sleep, did you?
That's right. And particularly if you had a mission the next day.
Yeah.
And
did you go out back-to-back days? Was that infrequent?
It was infrequent.
Okay.
But it did happen. I did.
And typically, how many, in a week, how many days would you go out on bombing missions?
Oh, for that? From D-Day on, that was a function of weather.
Weather, okay.
It was a function, and the weather, from D-Day, the weather was really stinky.
Yeah.
And we went out, but the weather was just not adequate for doing a good bombing job.
If the weather was...
At D-Day, at that time, Mr. Eisenhower thought that our strategic bombers were going to be good to support infantry and to support the ground troops, which is a horrible mistake. That's not what we were designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
He quickly found out, but at least we went to, I don't know, 3 times over there. You didn't know what you were bombing.
Was that the problem? What was the challenge in bombers serving as support for infantry?
Well, I think they thought they wanted to get as much firepower in without high casualty losses as they possibly could.
So without casualty losses on our side.
That's on our side.
Right? Yeah.
And they thought, if you can knock out their defenses and you could disrupt their troop movements and things, it would help our forces get a foothold over there.
And why didn't it work?
With our heavy equipment, they're just not suitable for that sort of thing. They want to send us fighters and the light bombers.
Rather than the heavy bombers.
Yeah, the heavy bombers are just not suitable for doing that.
So what you could do is, inland, you could bomb railroad sites, mm-hmm. terminals, big major terminals, or you could bomb cities, but to bomb in support of infantry in armor was, you were just at too great a range to be effective.
Well, that's right, and we weren't equipped for high-level strategic bombing was what we were designed to do, to use the Norden bomb sight, and the bomb sight was a good piece of equipment.
Why don't we take a break right here? I could stand
a coffee now.
Okay, this is David Colburn with Bruce Rogers. We just took a brief break of about 5 minutes. We're picking up our interview. Bruce Rogers is stationed in the UK. His bombing group, he's been assigned a bombing group. He has flown into Europe, and we'll pick it up from there. And Bruce, go ahead and tell us a little bit about what a typical bombing mission was like, the flight out, the target area, etc.
Well, generally, once the established course and target, of course, you knew, was established and you reached your assigned altitude, which was generally 30,000 feet, you're on oxygen, and the airplane was apparently fit, your engines were all hitting up 2131, we were at 168 knots. All of a sudden,
how'd you stay warm? Because these things weren't heated, were they?
These were not heated. So you had an electric suit, which was operating on low voltage, and of course we were dressed in pretty substantial leather gear, fur lined, had silk gloves on and leather gloves over the top. You wouldn't dare touch any of the metal, and your hands would freeze to the metal because it got, generally, it was 47 degrees below zero. We were all on oxygen. Above 12,000 feet, we had oxygen masks on, so there's a side issue. Everybody said, why did you shave in the morning? Well, you shaved in the morning because an oxygen mask over whiskers is very unpleasant. So you shaved, put your oxygen mask on, and it had to stay on basically for pretty close to 8 hours.
Did your bomber have a name? I know a lot of the Air Force people gave their bombers names.
Well, yeah, we did in a way, but you never knew for sure what plane you might get assigned to. It would switch. If they could give you the same plane, you did. In the early bombing stages, 1943, 42, when our guys really started over there, they had their own airplane. There weren't that many planes they could assign them. Most of those guys were given a go-home signal after 25 missions, and they probably were entitled to it. But we were actually working on a lot of replacement aircraft that came over there, and if your plane lost an engine or it got damaged, they would give you another plane.
Were they all the same bombers?
Yes.
B-17s. All B-17s.
Right.
Okay.
They were all, in my time over there, they were all B-17 G-series. G-series were the first group that had the chin turret added to it. The old F models didn't have a chin turret in the front, so that they were exposed to a frontal attack by fighters. And so they added a chin turret, automatic chin turret, which was a good addition. And they made a G model out of it.
And that was the turret that was right below the front?
Right here.
Yeah. And what kind of machine gun did they have in there?
.250 caliber.
.250 caliber, okay.
So we had, I think we had 2, 4. We had better than 20 .50 caliber machine guns on there. And so.
And how many, what was the weight of the bombs you were carrying, the size of the bombs?
That was a variable. We could carry 2,000-pound bombs, but you could only carry two of them. You could carry 1,000-pound bombs. I could carry six of them. Now, some of this wasn't a function of weight. It was cubic capacity. That airplane bomb bay was only so big, and your shackles to hold the bombs were such that the weight loading and the distribution and the capacity, actually the cubic capacity, is the limiting factor. So when they say there was, you carry this many pounds of bombs, you could carry a lot more weight with small bombs than you could big bombs. 500-pound bombs or 100-pound bombs, you can carry a bunch of them.
Well, so tell us, I interrupted you.
The bombs or the armament that you carried on there was a function, too, of the target that you were going to go to. Now, if you were going to hit, you were going to knock the dam out or hit the subpens at Kiel, where you were going through heavy concrete, would use a different kind of bomb than you would if you were going to scatter bomb and knock out a plant producing Focke-Wulf 190 airplanes in Germany.
I apologize. I interrupted you, and you were telling me about a typical flight over. And before you got to the bomb site, describe again, if you would, what it was like. Right. Just flying up.
When you approached your initial point, which was usually maybe 25 miles, 30 miles to the downwind side of your target, and that was usually the area where you first would start to run into your anti-aircraft fire from your ground defense forces would come into action.
And you said prior to that, it was the flight over was really a calm experience.
Spectacular. If all your engines were running properly and the formation was going, it was smooth as could be and very cold, but very peaceful. And when the anti-aircraft guns started up, it was pure terror. You were flying into a flak area, which was hard to explain, but it was pure terror. You sat there and you kept your fingers crossed that, boy, don't let them get near me.
How good and were the Germans firing these artillery weapons? What were they, 88s?
They were generally 88s, most of them that were getting up to 30,000 feet. It was unique because we would probably run into fighters as we approached the target. They're doing two things. One, they were going to knock down our bomber stream, but number two, they were telling those anti-aircraft gunners down below, these guys are at 30,000 feet, although they didn't say feet, they said meters, and they're flying on whatever the course was, and number two, this is their speed. And so these guys down below were cranking that information into their gun directors, and they would just put up 88 shells to 30,000 feet, and in mass, a new X-ray literally flew through it. Hopefully, if they were self-detonating shells, you hope they went off above you or below you, or but not on you. You could literally have one go through a wing or a spire and not explode. And put a hole in there. It looked like opened up a can of tomatoes. And that has actually happened. But it was scary. It was scary. And that lasted for the entire time you were coming in to your target. So you dropped your bombs and you left. Fighter attacks, you never had fighters hitting you while the flak was going out. They were away from there. They disappeared when the anti-aircraft opened up on you.
And imagine there was enormous relief when you were flying back and the plane was intact.
Very definitely. And once you got rid of the bombs and you started turning towards home and everything was intact, you looked at the fuel gauges and you didn't have any holes in your fuel tanks and you weren't leaking fuel, you were pretty happy. Mm-hmm. You were pretty happy.
Let's spend a minute or two talking about what life was like back in the base in the UK. What was the daily routine? Did you get time off at all during that period? But tell me about the routine first.
Okay, there was, in an off day, there was actually little to do. We had a officer's club and we had things like a pool table. They had a bar. They had some available stuff for exercise. We generally, I think a day when you knew you weren't flying a mission, you'd get up but you generally didn't get a chance to sleep in. Generally you were up, you had breakfast, and then you basically had time off. You weren't free to leave the base, but you had time to go in and play shoot pool. And a lot of times if you did not have a mission the next day, you spent some time at the bar. Even though most of us were under age drinkers, we still could, we should find out that they had pretty good beer over there, even though it was warm. It was pretty good.
Now, did you go into the town? What was the town nearby? Was it Snearden, the town near?
Our little town was Atterbury.
Atterbury.
And it was in bicycle riding distance from there. We all had bicycles. So that's the only way you could get around. And they had their pubs. This little town was on the railroads, was on the main line between there and Norwich and Ely. And they had a nifty pub there that had an interesting drink called cider, which is something that was new to us. But it was pretty potent stuff. And of course, not being a veteran drinker, we, about two of those things, you couldn't ride your bicycle back to the base. So that became an off day. If you didn't have to fly the next day, you could afford to imbibe on some cider and some beer.
What were the folks like in town? Did you interact with them much?
We did to a degree. We always struck up with the families that were willing to take in laundry. We were pretty good traders. We, two or three things, soap was extremely short supply. I didn't smoke, so I always took my cigarette and cigar ration, and I could trade it for things like, one, butter, we never could get butter, and number two, soap, because it was non-existent, and they were able to acquire it in some fashion. And so they were very helpful in that regard. They were all farmers, most of them. The bases we were on were hogged right out of farmers' fields over there, and they laid the concrete down, and we had haystacks on our field, and in order to keep the grass down, they had goats and cattle instead of lawnmowers to keep the grass down. And so these were very nice folks. They were most of them pretty religious people. They all went to church on Sunday. And they had, at that particular time, it was a very difficult time for them. Food was not readily available. A lot of things were in short supply. Fuel for cars, there were a few cars. They had motorcycles and bicycles. Everybody had a bicycle. You rode everywhere. Mm-hmm. And you took a train everywhere. You didn't. There were very few buses, except in the cities they had transportation services, like in London and Norwich and Cambridge, they had buses. But
now, did you ever get to London during this period?
We did. I think we got to London on three occasions where we had leave. We had a break. We got to London. The last time was after the 5th of May in 1945, when the hostile war ceased. We got a break. I think we got a whole week where we weren't going to fly. So we got to London. And I think two other times, once after, I think, my 10th mission, I think they sent us down to London. Kind of a rest leave, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
to break the monotony of getting shot at.
What did you do in London when you went there? Just
We tried. Well, we'd go to a movie. We'd go to Piccadilly Circus and join in whatever was going on in London at that time. Tried their shops out for shopping. The American Officers Club there in London was a favorite spot for people to go. There was always some activity going on. If you wanted to get in a poker game or discuss what's going on or leave messages for some people you wanted to make contact with. We didn't do a lot of sightseeing. There wasn't the means to do that because we had no transportation.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't get to see that much of London. I mean, you saw a central part of London, that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And
tell us about the food on the base. What did you have, and What were the facilities like? I assume you stayed in Quonset huts or something like that?
We were in a Quonset hut with dirt floors, 55-gallon drum for a fireplace with a smokestack made out of 100-pound bomb casings that we salvaged. The thing that a lot of people, we had outdoor facilities for bathing. No walls, just bathtubs with a shower and big tub for hot water. So you got to take a bath about once a week if you were lucky. if somebody would heat up the water tub for hot water, on a daily basis, my ablution was my flak helmet filled with water that I heated up on top of the 55-gallon drum so you could shave, get hot water. And that was about it. It was adequate. It was certainly better than the infantry had, but it was rustic.
The food?
Food was good. And we had plenty of food.
Was it sea rations or?
We had, they got, for some ungodly reason, they caught up with the British having fried tomatoes for breakfast in the morning and stuff. We seldom got any milk. You had some canned cream or canned condensed milk, cereal, if you wanted to put that on it, scrambled eggs. They had some bacon, and we would get bread and toast, and it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember ever really complaining about the food. It became, after a certain point in time, it became monotonous because you got the same food, but it was adequate. I seldom remember anybody really complaining.
How many missions did you fly?
I flew 27 missions.
Was there...
Six of these were into the lowlands, which were to drop food. When there was a German pocket of resistance that had cut off the Netherlands from adequate medical supplies, food, the people were eating tulip bulbs. This is literally a fact. So we flew low-level missions, dropping any kind of food we could get inside that airplane in the bomb bay. Bags of flour, canned goods, and of course it was going to the Germans that were down there too, but the populace was getting some food, and it was quite some time before they let the first train, emergency trains, go in with medical supplies and things into places like Amsterdam and Utrecht and small towns.
Did you go and Belgium as well? As the Netherlands?
Well, the Belgian area was pretty much open. When we pushed through there and pushed the Germans back out, it was open. I don't know the geography, I think, in the lowlands is the thing that the Germans knew what they were doing, and they just stopped the railroads, they stopped the roadblocks.
Mm-hmm.
But their own troops were in the same boat as the population. They weren't getting any food either. Mm. They were struggling.
So six of your 27 missions were to drop supplies.
Supplies into the lowlands. Yes.
And of the other 21 missions, mm-hmm. What were some of the most difficult?
Oh, I think probably one was the Focke-Wulf plant in Frankfurt. That was the most difficult, I can tell you that. They shot me down. I was shot down coming back from Frankfurt. And their anti-aircraft was extremely accurate. I forget what the number of planes they got that day, but I think of our 48, I think we lost 10, including mine, due to flak.
Now, were you shot down on your way in?
On the way out.
On the way out.
Fortunately, we had dropped our bombs. They got, and I don't know to this day whether the flak got one of my turbos or whether it expired due to age, but they shot one of them out. So I lost two engines. And
were they on different sides or on the same side?
No, on different sides. Oh. Fortunately, but they also got my two waist gunners, and they were wounded, and we didn't know how badly. They were bleeding, head wounds bleed, and the radio operator who was back there tending to them, he wasn't sure whether they were still alive or not, but they were bleeding profusely.
Do you remember a date on that?
It was in November, and it was almost on my birthday. So I remember it was around, somewhere between the 20th and the end of November.
Okay, 1944.
This was 44.
Yeah. And so what happened as you were coming back? Did you make it back?
Well, I had to crash land. I had to put it down because I couldn't let those two guys who were wounded couldn't bail out. And so I had to decide, and then when the second turbo went out, I couldn't hold altitude. I had to come down and...
Did you have to come all the way?
I came down just east of Nancy, France, in a big old farmer's field. There's a little crossroads there whose the only thing I remember, I think it was something like St. Nicholas Place in a farmer's area. Was fortunately, I don't know how we were so lucky, but there were no trees.
And no hedgerows.
No, this was clear frozen ground. And all I could do is slow that thing down as far as I could and keep it flying and bring it down intact. And we did, all 10 of us. And we were there in a farmer's farmhouse, which was about, from where we came down, it was probably 300 yards away. And we, of course, at that time, we weren't exactly sure where the German lines were, fortunately. So we pulled the two guys that were wounded out. By then they were conscious, but still bleeding. And one guy couldn't see because of blood. So he was the lighter of the two. He was being carried. We made it to the farmhouse. And no one there. We never saw anybody. We didn't see anybody for 9 days. How lucky can you be? So,
and who?
The only thing we can think of is that the German military had been through there, and they must have either taken the farmer people that were there in the house with them, or they took off on their own for whatever reason. Of course, they were French, and the Germans, of course, right there, that's an area which... Well, it's French. We never saw them. And we lived on their, stuff in their root cellar there for 9 days. So our troops came in, and we thought we were going to be captured. We thought they were Germans.
Oh, did you? You thought there were German troops coming?
Yeah, but they were our troops.
Had you been able to communicate with anybody?
No. Well, we didn't want to. We didn't want to build a fire, because that would... And we couldn't understand why, if there were German troops or anything in the vicinity, would have seen our plane come down. But no one, we never saw a soul. We didn't see any livestock. I mean, it was unbelievable. So we ate Brussels sprouts for 9 days. And the hard candy we had, the concentrated stuff they give you, we had that. And we were dying for some toothbrushes or toothpaste to brush your teeth. And fortunately, we were dressed for the cold, because it was cold.
That was a severe winter, that winter of 44, 45.
Yeah, it was bad flying weather, but we were lucky.
Who came to your rescue?
Part of Patton's group, an advanced scout group, came in.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, sure, they were Germans. We thought our number's up. But
Where did they take you from?
We got rides from them. They sent a weapons carrier over, and they took us all back. I guess it was in the city of Nancy. And then turned us over to their commander. I should remember this guy's name. He was a colonel. And he said, we'll get you guys back so you can have another airplane and come back and fight some more. We said, well, after 9 days, well, first of all, they fed us. We got some on-the-road army food. But we were shuttled all the way back to Le Havre, and then came back across to the UK. In between, they did notify our commanding officer that we were alive and kicking.
Were the two gunners still alive? Did they make it?
They had superficial head wounds. But boy, I'll tell you, when you saw them with the blood, we were hit on both sides, and I think the only way I can see it is it was reflective shots off their guns on the side that reflected through the plexiglass and hit them in the head. Mm. And this happened on both sides. Mm. So
when the American troops, Patton's troops came on you, how did you communicate so that they didn't shoot you?
Well, that was interesting, because I thought they were going to do that. It took a couple of minutes in talking with the advanced guys that we were Americans and that there's our airplane, and they saw it, which I think was better than words.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you tell us the truth. Because they had communication, they had phones in there, because they were ahead looking for Germans, and they were communicating back, so they had, I don't know what you're calling VHF, that wasn't VHF, it may have been VHF.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And of course they had American troops that had some experience with Germans masquerading as Americans.
I would assume so.
Who could speak English, and that's so they had to be really cautious when they came on you.
He was pretty cautious until he could see the airplane set out there. So these guys are speaking the truth.
Did you see them coming, or did they?
We heard them.
You heard them.
We heard him. Yeah, it was a motor vehicle. We had a Jeep.
Okay.
Yeah. And we figured, uh-oh, until we could see it was one of ours.
Mm-hmm.
At first, when we heard it, I said, okay, our number's up. They're going to, whether they saw us or not, we were very careful. Actually, we didn't build a fire. There was no smoke, and that's one of the reasons we didn't set the demolition charges off on the airplane. And that was one of the things we did. We had chargers in the G-boxes, which we didn't want them to get, and the Norden bomb sight. And we said, if we set that off, that's going to announce our arrival. Move.
When you got back, did they debrief you on everything that had happened?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to know what happened. They're quite interested in the fact that that both turbos went out. It was one of the prime reasons why we lost the engines. And I couldn't honestly tell them. I said, I know they got the one, was Flak. The other one, I don't know. It may have expired due to old age or whatever. But it disappeared, and I said, why? We were lucky enough to have it on alternate sides. We were lucky.
How long after you returned did they have you back up in the air again?
A week.
A week?
Just a week, yeah.
And did the both gunners go back up with you, or were they still...
No, they went. Well, they gave them a whole month off. They sent them down to Oxford to a flak home. And they were tickled pink. They're not going up for a while. Yeah.
Well, Bruce, why don't we stop there, and we'll pick it up from this point next week, and follow through to the end of the war, and then what happens to your life after that. How's that sound?
Sure.